All right. So thank you all for putting up with the fact that I couldn't make the Sweden. My son is feeling better, and thank you for your understanding. So today, let me just get this started. I've been invited to talk a little bit about inventing the future of librarianship. So my name is David Lankus. I'm from Syracuse University, School of Information Studies. I'm the incoming director of our Library and Information Science Master's Degree Program. Also run several research projects. So before I get into the heart of the matter, I want to give some introductory notes to keep in mind as I'm going through today's presentation. The first note that I will bring up is that I have a clearly, when I'm formulating and talking about this and my experiences, sort of a clearly North American perspective, and within that, frankly, United States perspective. So, you know, all the standard imperialist American stuff stands. So I have a lot to learn from what's going over in Europe. In fact, one of the unfortunate circumstances that I'm not here is that I'm, or that I am here, that I'm not there to learn about it. But so as I speak, a lot of this will come from our experiences here in the U.S. I think a lot of it should translate, but a lot of it you're going to sort of have to help me figure out how to translate. The second perspective that I bring in this presentation is sort of an Alan Kay-ism. So this is Alan Kay, and he worked for the Park Research Labs. And his famous quote, which I love, is the best way to predict the future is to invent it. So I have a very sort of inventionist view of things. I really look forward to the what is the future of libraries, and I don't sort of see it as a set in stone thing that we're going to discover on the way. And I don't see it as something we're just going to look at the trends and be able to know what it is. I think we really need to be proactive in creating it. Let me give you an example. The MacArthur Foundation here in the U.S. approached me at one point and said, Dave, we would like you to find out what is the future of libraries. So this was their question. You know, you have a month, so take your time with it. So I would get on the phone and I would call directors of public libraries and other academicians and scholars and say, all right, so what is the future of libraries? And invariably they would say things like, well, what do you mean? What is the future of public libraries or academic libraries or special libraries or school libraries? And what do you mean future? And it just led to more questions. And what we discovered is this is a really bad question to ask. Because what if, for example, you find that the answer to this question is there is no future for libraries? Are you satisfied with that? Is that okay to say, you know, libraries, sure, it's been my life up to this point, but I'll let it pass. I don't think you are. And so, in fact, as we were talking and working through, a brilliant doctoral student of mine, David Pimentelli, says, you know, are you asking what is the future of libraries or what should the future of libraries be? And the other thing is, in talking around to all these folks, we found out that it's really no longer about libraries as institutions and buildings and facilities. It's really about the professionals and people within those and what they do. And so let me give you a suggested refinement of this question. And that is, what should be the future of libraries and librarians in a democracy? Just really quickly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the first is should be that we really do control our own destiny. And I have a real strong belief and knowledge that librarians are up to the task of ensuring that they have an ideal future. That I believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, not behind us. And I think a lot of what librarians need to do is stop worrying about what other people are doing or worry, you know, what is Google doing? What is this doing? And start focusing on what we can do effectively. And I think as I talk about that today, if we do that, we're going to find out that there's a huge contribution that librarians can make to today's changed and accelerated society. And in fact, we can be more important than ever. And the librarians part is, once again, libraries are abstractions. Things that, you know, they're either buildings or they're books or they're organizational charts. But what it really comes down to is to librarians. You know, a room full of books is called a closet. You know, a room, an empty room with a librarian in it, that's a library. And if they have an internet connection, within 10 minutes, they'll have a collection, they'll have services, they'll start having people come in, they'll probably have to tell 10 people where the bathroom is. But it's all about librarians and the professionals. And the inner democracy thing, I think, is particularly important in Nordic libraries. As I read about them, this is central. But obviously in the U.S., this is central as well. And I think that this notion of our more grand social purpose often gets lost in discussions of technology. that we spend so much time worrying about how we do things and what tools we can bring to a problem that we forget that the ultimate goal here is to make society better. So with that, here's my outline for the rest of my presentation. And I'm hoping that through the miracles of technology, we'll be able to have some questions and answers at the end. So what I want to talk about first is this need for reflection. Then I want to talk a little bit about bridging the theory to the practice of librarianship. Then I want to talk really specifically about centering librarians on learning and knowledge and the consequences that if we say that librarianship is fundamentally about knowledge and learning, it changes a lot about what we do, and I think for the better, but I want to explore that. I'm going to explore that through a specific project that we're working on, the Atlas of New Librarianship, walk you through what that is. And then finally, sum it up with the idea of what is our true impact on learning, and what is the true impact of putting that at the core of what we do. All right, so with that, it's a shame that I can't be in Sweden, but it's a shame that I can't be in Sweden more for me than for you, hopefully, because this technology really represents a fundamental reality that we live in. That when we serve our students, when we serve our faculty, yes, they may be sitting in a building next to ours or on, you know, floors above or floors beneath, but sometimes they're sitting in other continents and other places. You know, my favorite reference librarian who I go to on a daily basis works out of Seattle, which is literally a continent away. That my favorite radio station is out of Phoenix, which is three time zones to the west. That the overwhelming majority of students that I teach, I never meet until they show up for the diploma. We exist in this world. And this technology that we're in will only get better and make it more seamless, but it's a fundamentally new reality. And so we need to really stop and think about not only a new reality from what technology allows us, but what that does to us socially, what that does to us culturally, what that does to the notion of democracy. So I think this is a quote by a fellow named Derek Law, who just recently wrote in a UK piece on the future of libraries. He says, librarians have become so busy and adept at keeping the library efficient and well-managed that we have lacked the space to step back and observe it from a higher level. And I agree with this 100%. And first of all, librarians should really pat ourselves on the back. Think about the amazing technological changes that have happened in the past 10, 20 years. What the personal computer has done, what universal connectivity has done, what, you know, Finland just passed a law saying that high bandwidth connections are a fundamental human right. I mean, that's a pretty amazing statement. And that's a dramatic change from where we were before. But also think about the demographic shifts. Think about the cultural shifts. Think about the political shifts that we've seen. Librarians have sort of weathered a lot. And it's interesting, in the States, we, in this economic meltdown that we're in the middle of, we had the Great Depression in the 30s. Now we talk about the Great Recession right now. And something really interesting is happening, which is as the economy gets worse, there are more and more stories about librarians on the news, in newspapers, on television, on radio. People are talking about libraries. And they're all, this is just a quick, on, you know, Google search on increased public library usage. And you can see that the first five results here are all about articles about how libraries are getting more and more usage. Could show you things from our nightly news and from cable news and such. But they're all about, all right, people don't have money. They suddenly realize there are these things called libraries and they go to them. Now, I will point out, of course, these are in the public library sphere, but work with me for a moment. And so people could say, why step back? We survived the past 20 years. Our usage is increasing. We're doing just fine. Why bother reflecting on deeper theories and concepts when what we should be doing is worried about how to get more stuff out to people? Not only that, but on a research setting, we're busy, right? That we're busy trying to figure out what Dublin Core is and how we integrate that with our catalogs. And we have all this whole semantic web thing to worry about. And how do we deal with XML and schema and RDF? And on the virtual reference side, you know, do we like IM or what should these systems really look like? Is question point enough? What's the interface? And, of course, in our spare time, we worry about the couple of social networks that we have to keep up with, right? So we're busy. Stop talking about reflection. We're doing just fine. Things are going along great. We got plenty to do. Stop bothering us. Okay. here's the problem with what I call a functional approach, which is librarians are defined by what they do. And that is, if you miss the deeper theory and concepts, you begin to misjudge the data you're looking at. So let's take that comment that in the States, public library usage is increasing because of the economic downturn, right? Money goes down, people are coming to the library. If that's your logic, you do a couple of things. The first thing you do is you say, oh, we need more free stuff. We need more books. We need more DVDs. We need a lot to keep doing what we're doing. But something really interesting is happening. If you take a look at some of the statistics, so this is one, 50 states in the United States, one of them. This is Iowa, sitting in the middle of the state. And if you look at the checkouts, right, so if you look at their circulation, an interesting thing happens, which is you see this big upward trend, and you go, of course, economic turndown. But notice down there the x-axis. This trend started in 1998. There was a blip in 99 and then 2000. That this has been a decade-long expansion. We see the same thing in visits to a physical library, that over the past decade, we've seen increases of usage. Around the United States, when I go to state libraries and state places, this is a 20-year story. This is not a last 2-year story. That if you look at this and understand the data in a deeper way, you begin to say, wait, what we should be doing is not more of the same. It should be more of what we started doing in 98. And what was that? Well, let me ask you a question as academic librarians, which is, how are your database usages going? Right? How is your reference inquiry going? I'm guessing it's going down. How is your circulation going? Yeah, maybe static. How is the use of online full text databases? Blowing through the roof. What we see is when libraries began transitioning to digital systems, when they began transitioning to web-based systems, when they began transitioning society to a more information-consuming society, librarianship went up. George Needham of OCLC talks about the idea that there aren't book people and internet people and TV people. People don't sort of self-select based on the media that they consume. What they do is you have information people and non-information people. People who really try and filter and minimize their information aren't going to use libraries a lot, and they're not going to read newspapers, and they're not going to spend a lot of time on the net. People really interested and addicted to information and checking their email every 10 minutes and RSS feeds and such, we'll take it from wherever we can get it. We're omnivores when it comes to information. So how do we then, on one hand, take this deeper theory and conceptual knowledge, the ability to look beyond practice, and fuse it with the really good stuff we're doing in functional worlds? How do we build a bridge between these two worlds? And I think that a major theme of this conference has it dead on, which is the bridge for me is around knowledge and learning. If what we do is we say librarianship is not about things, it's not about stuff, it's not about books and databases and materials, we have to stop giving up the idea that librarians' jobs are collections and the collections are the value. No, the librarian's job is about knowledge and learning. Collections may help us get there, but that's where our fundamental value is. So what happens if we start and take a look at it and recenter librarianship around these concepts? And how do we do it? Well, I'm going to propose a mission to you, a mission for librarians. And that mission is, the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. Now, before I break this down a bit, I want you to notice a few things about this mission. The first of all is the mission of librarians. It's not a mission of a library. It's not a mission of an organization. It's not a mission of bricks and mortar. It's not a mission of a budget statement. It's your mission. It's every individual's mission. It's really easy when you phrase things as the mission of the library to sort of become abstract and say, well, someone in the library will worry about that. I am doing this, right? Well, that's the administration's view. This is mine. No. Every individual librarian, whether you work at an academic library, public library, whether you're an information consultant, whether you work at a large corporation, whether you work as a librarian but you bring your librarian values into it, it's your mission. And what is that mission? To improve society, right? We could stop it right there. And that sounds really lofty and really highfalutin. But that's what we need to be, right? Ultimately, if what we're doing has an impact, an effect, we want it to be positive. And if what we can do is have a positive impact on our communities, no matter how limited they are, our academy, our geographical area, our country, our interest group, then we should be advancing society as a whole. And how do we do it? Do we do it through books and materials and dissemination and distribution and informing? No. We do it through facilitating knowledge creation. When people come to our libraries, they don't come to get something. There's a famous line that people don't like to search. They like to find. People don't come into our libraries because, hey, what the heck? They come in with an attempt to do something, to learn something. Maybe it's social. But particularly in an academic library, when they come to the library, online or in person, they're coming to learn. And our job is to facilitate that knowledge. And that may mean giving them stuff. That may mean giving them resources. But it may mean talking to them, giving them a comfortable space. It may mean helping them create materials and write their next book, etc. So given this mission, we have lots of threads off of it, lots of ideas that we can expand, right? Because if this is that theory conceptual view, how do we get down to practice? Well, what we need to do is we need to link them. So let's start with what I call threads off of this. And we've got the mission. Well, what is a mission? When you say the mission of a librarian is, how is that formulated? What does it mean to be a librarian? I mean, does that mean that I have a graduate degree? Or does it mean that there's something fundamental that was brought to me as part of that degree process? What do I mean by improved society? What do I mean by facilitation? What are the methods of facilitation? Knowledge creation, we're going to go into that one first. And communities, ultimately, what do we need to know about these communities that we serve? Now, we could break this down in ad infinitum, but I'm going to pick one. So I'm going to take knowledge creation here. And we're going to break knowledge creation into a couple of different parts. All right? So well, I'm now sort of moving in. All right, so what do I mean by knowledge creation? Well, we got to start with what is knowledge. And knowledge is created through conversation. This comes from a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask, and he developed something called conversation theory. He was trying to teach machines to think, and he said, well, until they catch up, I'll use how people think. And he was examining how people learn. And what he came up with is that people learn through conversation. And I'll break that down into a little bit more elements. But what I want you to notice about that is that conversation is an interaction of two sort of intelligent people. Let me show you what knowledge isn't. Knowledge isn't a thing, in this case, a rock, right? The idea of recorded knowledge doesn't exist. You can't record knowledge. That makes it static. Knowledge is dynamic. It's living. It's constantly changing, and it's inherently human. Now, I know this is getting really theoretical, but one thing I found when I've dealt with library community over in Sweden when I was in Borås a couple of years ago, is that the Europeans tend to be very conceptual and deal with epistemology, and the Americans, in terms of library and information science, tend to be sort of mercenary and practical. And so let's see if we can meet in the middle here. And we'll start over here. And so if we look at this rock, right, it's Ayers Rock. It's sitting in the middle of Australia. You know, a geologist can take a look at this rock, and they can tell you when it was formed, how old it is, what its composition is. An anthropologist can look at this rock, and they can tell you things like its cultural significance to the Aboriginal population. I look at this rock and think about the trip I took with my wife to Australia, and it makes me happy. Now, what's interesting is none of that information is in the rock. Right? It's the geologist brings that knowledge to the rock. I can't walk up to the rock and say, oh, this was formed in XYZ process how many millions of years ago, because I don't know it. The knowledge is not in the thing. The knowledge is in the people interacting back and forth. So knowledge is a living, dynamic thing. So let me break that down a little bit more. If this comes out of conversation theory, what does conversation theory teach us about knowledge? Well, it says knowledge consists of a couple of things. The first thing that is a conversation. The first thing that, deep breath, take a moment. Conversation theory. Well, what are the conversants? What are the elements developing knowledge? The first are the conversants. Who's talking back and forth? So right now, you and I are having a very one-way conversation. Hopefully it'll become two-way, but we're conversants. Conversants can also be two organizations talking. It can also be within me, the individual having a conversation with themselves. If you're sitting there right now going, what is he talking about? Who are you talking to? Right? You're having a conversation with yourself. So the fabulous thing is that when you look at a book or a web page or something, this is not knowledge. When you're reading a book, you're having a conversation. You're not having a conversation with the book, because it can't rephrase itself. You're not having a conversation with the author, because for all we know, they could be dead. So who are you having a conversation with? Yourself. Do I believe this? Do I understand this? How does it integrate? How does it make sense? So the first thing we need to know about developing knowledge is created by two conversants. Now, what are those conversants doing? Those conversants are exchanging language back and forth, right? So we're using English. If you were using Swedish back, it probably wouldn't be a terribly efficient conversation from my end. But this language going back and forth. And language, as I'll show you in a minute, exists on a couple different levels. And what we're doing through these conversants exchanging language is that they are seeking agreements, right? What can they agree upon? All right, Dave said knowledge is this. Dave said knowledge has this part and this part and this part. All right, I agree, right? Or it's nice outside today, or can we agree that, etc. So they like facts, but they can be of all sorts of things. They can be opinions held in common, all these kinds of things. And the most important agreement is agreeing not to agree. That at some point in conversation, you can simply say, we're not going to come to a solution. Let's stop here. The last element that conversation theory talks about is a memory, which is over time, these conversants are exchanging language. They're coming to agreements. It's important that they remember those agreements from one conversation to the next, right? And so your memory is how you structure your knowledge of the world. It's dynamic and it's relational. That when you look at memory, memory is not stored as a set of little factoids sitting in boxes. It's sitting as a web, or what Pass calls an entailment mesh. But we'll get that in a second. So if you see what we're doing here, we're taking this large concept and we're breaking it down further and further. We're doing this, what I'm previewing for you is a project we're working on called the Atlas of Librarianship, which takes that central mission and breaks it down from concepts and theories down to practical and examples. So let's keep going with this. So what we can do now is, if we've got the mission about knowledge, what is knowledge is created through conversation, as explained in conversation theory, which has these components, let's take that language thing again. Now, there are two types of language that Pass talks about. The first language is what's called L0, and the second is L1. Now, these are simply ways of talking about sort of the level of conversations we're having. So when someone walks up to the reference desk in a library, they are maybe talking, and they don't know what they really are looking for. You're going to have an L0 conversation first. It's a very low, very directional, very how kind of oriented language, where you're simply negotiating about how to negotiate. I need to find an article. What topic do you need that article on? It's got to be about this topic. Okay, now let's talk about the topic. Now, L0 was all setting up and preparing for that conversation, the negotiation. L1 is, now we're going to understand something at a deeper level. So in this community, when I say the word catalog, you don't think about places to shop and pieces of paper to look through. Whereas anyone outside, you know, normal people outside of librarianship, they think catalog, they think shopping, they think paper and inventory of things I can buy. We mean it in a very different level. So we can have an L1 conversation. Now, what's important about this is, think about the systems that we build and provide to users. And think about, why is it that they work or don't work? For example, there are lots of studies that look at the efficiency of people searching for information in library catalogs. And what we find is that librarians are extraordinarily efficient and effective at searching through catalogs. And average end users are horrible at it. Why? Well, part of it is because we assume different levels of language. When a librarian interacts with a system, they're able to use classifications, they're able to use controlled vocabularies, authority control. They understand the underlying L1 interface that's going on. When a user walks up, they have no clue. So they put in keywords, and keywords are just not good at retrieving things out of bibliographic systems. So we have a problem here, which is when we build systems, if we don't understand language usage, the systems we build will miss the target audience. So what L1 does is it starts to talk about how can we evolve the systems that we use, right? So what do I mean? Well, sort of early thinking about online systems were what I call the systems view. I don't just call it that. In information science, this has been long discussed. So the early days when it cost you $1 to run a query on Dialog, or you had to put in card catalogs and stuff, it was expensive. And so it made sense to make very specialized systems that use very specialized language and spend a lot of time training the person searching the system in that specialized language, right? So in the system view, you had an expert and you had the system and they had to speak the same language, right? This has been really replaced by the predominant thing called a user-based view or user-based design. This is where we go out and we try to understand the problem from the perspective of the user. And once we understand and define the problem, we build a system around it. So hopefully we use the language of the user population. Hopefully we use the assumptions and the kinds of things going on. Now, there's a problem with user-based systems, which is since the user is not actually building the system, there's still an interpretation going on for what they need to know. The other thing, and not that anyone has ever done this, is the fact that if you ask enough users, you'll find your own opinion in there somewhere. And so user-based design sometimes doesn't mean much because we just sort of keep talking to users and keep hearing what we want to hear out of it. So we're really moving to a new type of design, which is user systems, where the users build the systems around themselves. Because here's the trick. That catalog where the librarian understands that sort of L1 has this really complex language they can work with, the user doesn't, it makes it sound like, oh, we just need to develop an interface for the user. But saying that users are somehow homogenous is problematic. And once again, if you sit at the reference desk, this happens all the time. Someone comes in and say it's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, comes up to the reference desk and asks the questions about physics. They have an L0, a very low understanding about library language, but they have a very sophisticated L1 understanding of physics. And the librarian on the other side of the desk is the opposite. Right? So what we need to do is not think about finding the right language and implementing the right system. But we need to talk about how do we build systems so that users can use their own language and that system can support millions of different L1s. And the example that we're seeing right now is in the use of social network sites. So when you look at something like a library thing or Facebook, when people go in, they build the systems around them, right? Oh, I want a blog here. Oh, I want to add a picture here. Oh, I'm going to take a quiz to tell me how Swedish I am over here, right? What they're doing is they're using their own system to incorporate it. When they bring in materials, they're using things like tags to use their own taxonomies to organize them. And Facebook doesn't care. Facebook doesn't say, no, you must call it these things. In fact, when you look at systems that allow users to do that, like Facebook and MySpace, their market share goes like this. When you look at systems that sort of try and get people to conform to one language, like GeoCities, Yahoo had a place where you could build your own online presence. It was called GeoCities, but you had to use their language, their tools. Their usage is going away. So you see this notion in encyclopedias. You look at the use of Wikipedia, where people can use their own terms, their own language, and create their own spaces. And you look at Encarta and Britannica and sites that don't allow users, and they go down. There's this pressure for participation that says, as systems allow me to represent my own language and my own knowledge, I'll use them more. So why should libraries be involved in social network sites? See how we're trying to bridge from the really abstract to the practical? Because social networking sites and the idea are user systems. And by building more user systems, by incorporating these ideas into our own systems, we can allow users to learn better. That in essence, it's not just a matter of being trendy and, ooh, let's be in Facebook because that's where the kids are. We want to be able to say, gee, we should build systems like Facebook in that they allow people to build their own level of expertise and their own type of system. So we may end up at the same place we are now from a technology functional view, but we end up there for a reason, and we understand what we need to do in those environments. By the way, one last line. I think that we need to stop every conversation about the next generation catalog and ensure that this is the last generation catalog. We need to replace catalogs. We need to replace them we need inventory systems that the librarians see, but we need true discovery and social systems, knowledge-based systems, and I'll talk about that in a second, that users can see. In fact, let's go there now. So notice what I've done is I've switched here a little bit. There's language, that thread that's still going there. But now let's take a look at memory. Now I mentioned before, memory isn't just a set of these categories things fit in. Memory is relational. What do I mean by that? Well, PASS talks about things called entailment meshes and entailment structures. And what it means is when you have terms, they have relationships together. So, for example, if I give you the word light, L-I-G-H-T, in English, light, what do you mean? What does it mean? Now, some of you may think, well, that means not heavy. Some of you may think, oh, it means illumination, turn on the lights. And some of you may even think set on fire, to set something alight. That's all the pyromaniacs in the room, please take a step left. Right? The point is that your brain just sort of jumps to one because it's got so many relationships. Now, if English is a second language, you may not have so many relationships, but I can't give you a Swedish example. I apologize. So now take a word like OMG. All right? Think about OMG. What does it mean? It means, oh my God, right? You probably didn't think about Omni Media Group or the Omni Media whatever or other. You sort of thought either texting or instant message and you knew what it meant. Why not all this ambiguity? Because there's a term where you have very few connections and they're very strong that do exist. Right? So if we can now look at our knowledge systems, the interaction that our users have, not as these catalogs and inventories around our language, but as a sort of open discovery space, what does that look like? Well, we developed a concept for something called Scapes. And what Scapes does is it looks like, instead of virtual reference software looking like this, right, where the user has to come to my library website, has to give me data, and then they have to wait on me, and I as a librarian have better tools than they do, and all they know me is librarian one, how could we redesign this kind of interface to more represent how people actually think? And so we developed this kind of interface. Now, in this interface, what you see along the side is on the left-hand side, you see an ongoing chat, and that chat can be with friends and librarians and 50 people at one time who said reference had to be a one-on-one experience. And on the right-hand side, what you see is a bunch of artifacts and materials, but the relationships within them. In this case, it's a set of songs and how they're related to the lyrics and how the lyrics are related to other systems. But notice, it's a mesh. It connects. In fact, if you are clever enough, you've actually noticed that that's what this is, right? What you're looking at in front of you with these circles and lines and whatever is not a series of ideas, but a series of ideas, literally agreements, in relation to one another. And what Scapes would allow you to do, what our system should allow a user to do, is to come in and say, think of it as a user walks into your library and they have a question. But rather than walking up to a desk, we set them in front of a table. And what they do is they put down a couple of books and materials and notes and they begin making piles. And then they can draw lines between the piles and say, these two things agree, these two things disagree, here's an idea here. And so you begin to build a relationship that isn't based on the Dewey Decimal or Universal Dewey classification, isn't based on Library of Congress classification or the Swedish Library. It's not based on a controlled vocabulary, it's based on their unique understandings. And not only can they draw out their own systems, but they can then connect them to other people's. And then what we can do is we can build search on top of those. So this is a project called Reference Extract. And what Reference Extract seeks to do is to say, all right, when I search for a book and I say more like this, what do I mean? So if I look for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone and I say more like this, do I mean more youth fiction? Do I mean more fiction about magic? But for me, more like this means the Star Wars complete encyclopedia of vehicles and the DK encyclopedia of Legos, because Harry Potter, Legos, and Star Wars are how I bonded with my now 9-year-old son. So in my mind, that's the relationship. And that's my unique understanding, and it's my L1, and why can't I represent that in your systems? Alright? So that just gives you, and then Reference Extract leads to the evolution of systems, which is we need to build these systems using user design. All right? So now what we can do is we can say, all right, there's one thread, one sort of trip from the high mission down to some specific examples. What are some other ones? Well, I mentioned before there are these different threads. So we can talk about, for example, the means of facilitation. What are the means of facilitation? Dave, you said before, I'm facilitating knowledge creation. If that's how knowledge creation occurs through these conversations, how do I facilitate it? Well, first thing you do is you provide access. Access to conversations. Or access to artifacts, like books, to start conversations. But it's access. Now, 90% of librarianship and education and budget and focus is on access. But we miss a really important part of access. And that's the notion of sort of agency. That not only do we provide access for a user to stuff we have, but we provide access for the community to the user as well. We have people who walk into our libraries that have really interesting ideas and they want to talk to people about them. Can we create a blog for them to post information out? Can we create a repository for their information? So the faculty member, I'm my own archivist, which is a horrible idea. Trust me, if you've seen my hard drive, I should not be an archivist. Right? But all my papers, all my articles, all my notes are sitting on this computer. Where does it go if I die, if I buy a new computer, if I install a new operating system that doesn't use the old files? I need to make sure that that information is available, and why not the librarian helping me do that? That when you look at institutional backup systems that we look at as an IT problem, we really need to look at that as an information problem. All right, you can back up all your faculty hard drives to the library, but what we're going to do is we have permission, or we will negotiate permission, to find the actual text of the articles you wrote, and we're going to preserve those over time. So access is not just getting the user to someone else's information. Sometimes it's getting more people to come to the user. What other ways can we provide facilitation? Well, baseline knowledge. So I'm a physicist or I'm a physics student. I come in, I have a question. And you say, oh, the best place to get that is online at this XYZ discussion group. And if the student says, I don't know how to get online, or I don't know what a discussion group is, we can provide basic literacy instruction into, here's the computer, and here's how to access a URL, and here's the discussion, right? So we provide baseline knowledge. That, yes, this is being talked about over in France, but I don't speak French. So either you're going to need to teach me French or help me find a place to learn French or find a way to translate this stuff. We access through an environment, which means, all right, the conversation is physicists in France happening over there. I've now given you the ability to go into that conversation, but have I made it so that when you go into that conversation, you feel safe doing it? Safe from the sense of maybe you're looking at things that aren't about physics. And through the intellectual openness, you can look at things that may not get social approval, maybe a minority view. We need to provide a policy environment to do that. And lastly, motivation. We have to understand why people are seeking out this information. Right now, librarians assume a lot of intrinsic motivation. That is, when people show up to the library, we assume that they want to learn and they're ready to learn. But that's not always the case. Sometimes they're compelled to learn. And one thing that librarians need to learn how to do, and this doesn't always make people happy, is how we can compel people to use things. So, for example, I mentioned the faculty backup process. If you would like to back up your hard drive and have a safe cloud-based backup, we need to be able to get your articles. We're compelling that use, right? If you want to get tenure at our institution, we're written into the personnel policies that the librarians are going to do your citation analysis. That's just, we're the ones who know how to do it. We're part of that process. We're compelling use. If you want to get research funds for our university, part of what you're going to do to get human subjects approval is you're going to put all your data on deposit in a secure environment in the library. That's compelling use. Okay? The last thing we need to understand about means of facilitation is that if we're truly going to facilitate these conversations, true facilitation means shared ownership. That in essence, when we do this, if we build this cloud-based environment where faculty are backing up, faculty need to have a say in that policy and process as well. Why don't we, for example, share stats? When a faculty member says, you know, I'm getting rid of, I'm retiring, here are all my books. Here's some shelf space to put it in, or here's something in our long-term storage. Librarians go, oh, but then we'd have to extension it, we'd have to catalog it. No, all we're doing is providing the space. Professor, you're in bin 48. If you want to get more than bin 48, here's how you can build catalog records. And we'll share them within our system. So now we understand how we build knowledge through conversation. We understand how we facilitate it. What are the other portions of the thread? Things like the importance of a worldview. When we talk about mission, a mission is more than just this is what we do. It's why we do it, right? And that needs to be founded on important deep theories of concepts. So a lot of libraries right now are talking about information commons and learning spaces. But do we understand really about learning? Or do we understand that that's neat architecture? For example, do we deal with the notion that when we bring a collaborative environment together and four and five people are collaborating, that doesn't happen magically. Sometimes you need to mediate the environment. Sometimes you need to understand some people will dominate a conversation, some won't. What about learning styles? when people come and they're looking through our online databases, do we even care about the idea that there are auditory learners, visual learners, haptic learners? Do we take that into account? How can we say we're building learning spaces if we don't understand anything about learning and learning theory? And the idea of creating a new social compact, which is, it's all well and good for me to say this is how we should happen, but does the faculty buy it? Do the students buy it? Do the administrators buy it? Do we, when we go ahead and take 50% of our library, create the collections that were taking up that space and put them off-site and create a learning commons space, have we discussed that so that the people who love the books and materials understand what's happening and how we're going to get it? Do we really, do people really understand what we do and how we do it? That's going to be a real social compact and understanding. So then we need to talk about communities. Communities put on this pressure for participation. They want to be part of us. If they're going to build user systems, they want to build. And so what does that mean? Well, first of all, we deal with things like, what does it mean in the physical environment? Well, it means that when you go and design the physical environment, you better talk to the people who are using them. So we worked with the Free Library of Philadelphia, and we said, okay, business community, how can the public library support the business community? And the original answer was, you can't. We're large corporations. We have our own librarians. Then they said something very interesting. But when I was starting my business, the free library was invaluable. Because I was at a corporation, I couldn't use their resources, or I was at home, I didn't have resources, then I used the free library a lot. So if you want to support the business community in Philadelphia, you need to support the startup and entrepreneurs, not the big corporations. And they said, this is how you do it. And so rather than the library business collection looking like a big facility, it began to look like something else. I jumped ahead real quickly. We did the same thing with the music community. What do musicians need? They said, this is sort of what the library looks like now, a lot of music in a place. And they said, like, and the musician said, no. It needs to look like two grand pianos on a stage. Because there's no place to perform in urban Philadelphia, and we need a place to do it, and performance is the only thing we care about. Also, when we're learning and collaborating with people, pieces of music and collaborators, our language, our L1 is music. It's not talking. And so sometimes we need to be playing to talk back and forth. And the business community said, this is not where you start small businesses. This is not how it looks. This is where you start small businesses. You need a computer to sit down, secured storage for your files. You need a boardroom to present to potential investment funders. You need field trips to startup businesses to find out how they did it. You need access to lawyers and et cetera. And so the point of this is that the community is going to tell you what it needs. And sometimes what it needs has nothing to do with what we can bind and put a barcode on. So we can talk about digital environments. Once again, are we just digitizing stuff and putting them online, or are we allowing conversation and manipulation to occur? And hybrid environments. We offer meeting spaces. Well, that's great, but what happens if one person of the team can't meet? Can they walk into a meeting space in our new commons environment and video record what they're doing, or do something like this and share it with the world? We need to talk about, what do I mean by improved society? Well, improved society is about activism, that librarianship is not just about passively doing things. It's active. Service is not invisible. When someone comes in and asks a reference question, and the first thing you do is either you start typing or you reach for a book, you've shown a bias. When you say, I present all perspectives on something, do you really? Do you really present, if someone asks you the history of Egypt, do you show things about, well, this is this historian, this historian, and this is the people who thought that the UFOs built the pyramid? Do you do that? Or do you say, well, these are the vetted resources? Right? So it's not invisible. What it is, it's a core value that we need to look at, not of being unbiased, but of being intellectually honest. I'm an LIS researcher. When I do a research study, do you really think I'm going to put a conclusion of, and therefore, we don't need libraries anymore? I don't think so. But I'm intellectually honest enough to say, I love libraries, and I think they're very important, and that's going to jaundice my results. So we need to look at our core values and how they fit in. Right? And so what we can do now is we also need to look at our skills, but realize that skills are fugitive. Skills change. They're not durable. And all the things from cataloging to collection development to reference work are skills. And so they may change. And so within skills, we talk about how do we transition information organization to focus more on how things are organized in relation to each other, and realizing that the user can create their own relation than universal systems of organization. we need to talk about the importance of technical skills, which is we can't do all of this by saying, oh, that's someone else's problem or computer science's problem. We need to look at how we educate. And one of the things that we need to worry about in education is, first of all, that librarians cannot have 2 years at the beginning of their career to know everything. We need to talk about doctorates, we need to talk about bachelors, we need to talk about coherent continuing education. And that curriculum needs to be focused more on change over traditional leadership. What that means is traditional leadership is there's the grand vision, go do that. Change is how do you sit down and convince people who don't want to do what they want, what you want them to do what you want to do. That was a long way to go for that comment. So that ends up with looking at sort of the major parts of it. And what we'll do is we'll just color code these lines briefly to make them easier to navigate. And what we can do with each one of these is we can break them down further and further and further. And in fact, you end up with something that looks like this. And so this is a conceptual map, the Atlas of New Librarianship, that takes these major concepts and breaks them all the way down from this lofty mission through the theory down into how we actually do it. And I didn't obviously have a chance to go through it all. I'm in the midst of writing a rather thick book about it. But it includes things like, what's the relationship of library science to information science? Are they the same? Aren't they the same? Things like assessment, which is, okay, Dave, if we're supposed to be working on conversations, how do we assess conversations? In the United States, our accrediting system, where we get accredited to be universities, have moved to outcomes-based assessment, where they walk up to a library and say, don't tell me the number of volumes, number of square feet, or the number of CERTs that you've had. We want to know how your service to these students led to them understanding this concept, getting an A and a B and a C. And you can't do that if you're based on the things, because as soon as you hand the thing to a student, you're done. But if you base it on the people, on facilitating knowledge creation, you care very much about what they learn. And so when you move to environments like this for distance education, where's the library? Things like issues of institutional repositories, the fact that they should look much more like public web of science than they should look like what they do now, Dublin core-based repositories, because we need to build systems that faculty understand as opposed to things that we understand. Being a publisher of a community, where people come to the library not because they want to learn about things other than your university, but they come to your library to learn about the university itself. And the last one I want to finish up with, I'm taking enough of your time, is something called the obligation of leadership, which is if the mission of librarians is to facilitate knowledge creation and ultimately to improve society, that means we need to be activists about it, that we need to, on a regular basis, study, discern, create. One of the things that drives me nuts is the idea that people look at innovation and they see big figures, you know, Steve Jobs and Newton and all these people that somehow it's this unworldly gift and it has to be so important that it changes the whole world. And it doesn't. Innovation is not a time slot or a person. It's a daily mindset that when you look at what you do on a daily basis, I had someone say, when am I supposed to innovate? I'm busy answering emails and checking out books and shelving things. When can I innovate? And I said, that's when you innovate. How can I answer these questions better? How can I spend less time shelving? How can I improve the answers that I give? Someone talked about having a no log. It was a piece of paper they had at the reference desk, and every time they had to say no, no, we can't do that, no, we don't have that, no, this isn't happening, they would write it down. And at the end of the week, they would look at the log and look at the log from all the other people, and they would find out we said no to the following activity 50 times. Maybe we should do this activity. Or maybe we should do a better job of informing the community that we don't do this, whatever it is, right? We need to constantly look at librarianship not as being a done and complete thing. It's changing, it's dynamic. If the best days are ahead of us, and I truly believe that the best days are ahead of us, then we need to innovate on a daily basis. We can't wait for others to do it, and we have to take a personal responsibility into that. We have an obligation to serve our communities. Yes, we need to serve them and make sure they're learning, but service is not invisibility and passive. Sometimes the best way to serve is to tell someone they're wrong. Sometimes the best service is speaking truth to power. Sometimes the best service you can do is not doing something or actively taking people in a different direction. Give up the idea that librarians are somehow unbiased and passive instruments within a library. They are the most fundamental and important perspective that a library has, and they're the ones who teach how things work. We need to lead. One of the things that drives me nuts, so I'm having this conversation and amongst librarians, and they're talking about How do we build institutional repositories and capture scholarly knowledge in this new world? People aren't just publishing papers anymore. They're doing blog postings and they're having discussions. They're doing virtual sessions like this. All of this gray literature is part of it as well. And I nearly shot myself in the head when the librarian sat there and said, yes, we need the faculty to tell us what we need to capture. And I said, are you nuts? People like me don't know. What we as librarians, we understand information, we understand knowledge, we understand organization. The last thing we should do is sit back and let another group determine how information and knowledge is captured and organized. This is where we should stand up and say we're part of that. We need to be active in this process, not passive. Ultimately, we have an obligation to innovate on a regular basis, to go in and say, how can we improve this environment? We cannot, if what we are is unbiased, we add no value. We are valueless. We can't be that. We need to look at our academies and say, the world is changing today. Distance education is changing. The information we consume is changing. The importance of that, economic development is changing. And we as librarians will innovate and figure this out with you, in partnership with you. And we have a perspective and we have a voice. Ultimately, the goal of librarianship must be about knowledge, must be about facilitation, it must be about improvement. How can we expect radical improvement and change from our communities if we remain conservative, risk-averse environments? We must be crazy radical people that scare the hell out of the environments that we work in. So with that, these slides will be available, the screencast will be available at my website. I know it'll be available through the conference as well. I thank you for your time, and I'm hoping we can work out a way to see if there are any questions.